This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Welcome to episode 10 of Herding Code. Tonight's topic is Link, which is a big topic, but I think we might revisit this and just start with some introductions this week. So Link is language integrated query. Just kind of curious if John or Kevin have used it at all in any of the code that they've been working with.
I've used it some. I worked on a project that was using Link to SQL, and then as part of doing that, I was working with a code base that someone else had started, and they were more aggressive in using it to do things like query checkbox values and just, you know, query everything, not just data. And so that really kind of got me thinking about using it as more of a language feature and not just a data query. But yeah, so I have made some use of it.
Excellent. Well, I believe it all started with the C# design team that was set on providing the ability to query data sources inside of C# using, you know, some people call it an embedded DSL. Some people just refer to it as all compiler tricks, but it's obviously in both Visual Basic and C# now in 2008. It had an interesting story, just some of the features that they had to add to C# to pull this off. So if you look at extension methods, the anonymous types, lambda expressions, expression trees, those are all there in C# 3.0 to support language integrated query, which wasn't necessarily a new idea. It's been in other languages before. Languages like FoxPro and Clipper, you could just write queries in those languages and start working with the results. But it's really kind of amazing to see it in a mainstream language, like one of the big four or five, C#, C++, Java, Visual Basic, to actually get into one of those languages. This feature I thought was pretty interesting.
I forget where I read it, but I remember reading something where they were talking about way back in, you know, adding generics and stuff going back to .NET 2.0 that was in preparation for adding Link. So it was pretty interesting that, you know, that they said like, yeah, we added this and this and this, but it's actually been like 4 or 5 years that we've been building up to Link. So it's pretty interesting to see how far like into the language it goes to allow for that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Kevin?
So apparently, you know, they say that all languages are evolving to become Lisp. Apparently, the whole languages are also evolving to become FoxPro. I didn't realize. That's pretty cool. Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to work with Link on a sort of production level basis yet, but I've sort of played around with it, and I find it entertaining to play. You know, you can sort of play stupid Link tricks, like eliminate all the for loops in your code. There's lots of interesting sort of language stuff that, you know, it provides a different way of thinking about, which I find pretty cool.
Yeah, and it's definitely introduced some functional programming aspects into C#, which is another topic for another day, I think. But just the ability to treat code as data and the ability to pass little chunks of code around and have them perform some actions is pretty interesting and can be rather powerful.
This kind of goes back a little bit to like Scott Kuhn was talking about a couple of weeks ago, talking about the Silverlight stuff, and he was saying, well, maybe this is just kind of the, you know, like a moon launch, and maybe this doesn't work, but we'll get a lot of cool things out of it. And I didn't really agree with him on that one, but with Link, it's interesting to see we kind of did get a little bit of that. Like, we got Velcro and computers and all this stuff out of the Link moon launch, because we have, like, anonymous types and extension methods and just on and on, like all these cool, interesting language things that people are still trying to get their heads around, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's interesting if you look at some of the early documentation of what the C# team was thinking. They were just thinking in terms of there's a sequence of objects that are out there, a sequence of objects, and you want to query them. So those objects might be employees. So let's come up with some sort of language where we can say, give me all the employees whose first name equals Scott. But we want this to be extensible enough so that those objects might be actually in-memory CLR types that are on the heap, so we can query those. But it might be that those objects are actually in a database and just haven't been materialized into memory yet. So we want the ability for that exact same query to actually be transformed into transact SQL and executed and pull back objects into memory. And the trick that they did to pull that off was the magic interface iQueryable, which all the extension methods on iQueryable, like the where operator, the select operator, sum, count, all those things that you do in a query, filtering and so forth, aggregating, instead of taking hunks of code that actually get compiled into intermediate language, they actually, with the C# compiler, when it sees the signature for those extension methods, it sees a special type called expression of T. And when the C# compiler sees that, it doesn't actually compile your expression that you use for filtering or grouping or joining or whatever it is. It doesn't actually compile that into intermediate language. It just builds an abstract syntax tree that represents your code as data. So if you have a where clause that says where e.firstname equals Scott, so you want to filter out the sequence of employees to find all the Scotts, it'll actually create an abstract syntax tree that says, okay, here, there's a binary operator. The operator is the check for equality, and on the left-hand side is this parameter, and on the right-hand side is a string literal called Scott. And the magic is you can plug in a link provider, which will get that syntax tree, and it can parse it, transform it into SQL, transform it into a web service call. And so the big technologies that shipped with Link were Link to SQL, which will take Link and transform it into Transact SQL. The Entity Framework, which essentially does the same thing, but they have a bit more of a robust provider model. So there's supposed to be providers coming for Oracle and DB2 and some other databases. And there's Link to XML, which is still essentially in memory. It doesn't really have to deal with expression trees. But then other people have created some really interesting link providers. So I know there's like a Link to Amazon where you can query the books on Amazon. Kevin found Link to WMI today. And apparently it's a little bit wacky. Is that true?
I haven't looked at that in that great detail yet, but WMI itself is a
WMI is complex.
DC technology. So I'm sure there's a lot there.
I know there's LDAP. So you can query an LDAP provider, and there's a few other popular ones out there.
There's a couple of links that I'll put in the show notes that have lists of, I don't know, maybe 25 or 30 different providers, link to JavaScript, link to JSON, link to Excel, you know. There's a, Roy Osherov did a link to regex, which I thought was kind of cool because it wrapped a Fluent interface around regular expressions in a kind of interesting way.
Mm.
So you basically write a long link query that defines, you just say where this, where this, where this, and it builds out a regular expression for you.
That is cool. The original, it's funny because the original intention behind link was language integrated query. So it's queries where you get strong typing, where you get IntelliSense, where you get compile time checks to make sure your query is actually going to work against the schema that you mapped your objects to in the database. But people have kind of taken off with the term link and sort of apply it to anything that involves lambda expressions or expression trees or things like that. So I know like Daniel Casalino, hope I got his name right, wrote a mock object framework called Mock, M-O-Q, which he keeps describing as link for mock objects, which essentially uses those expression trees to be able to specify the expectations of a mock object in a unit test. He also has some interesting examples on his blog about using link for a type safe reflection. So instead of specifying property names as strings to grab at runtime, using lambda expressions to get at things dynamically.
you know, I guess when you look at it kind of in retrospect, it's not something that, I mean, it's a common problem that you run into in just about in so many different ways. I wrote a post back in November of 2005, and it was titled "Why Not an Expression Query Language?" And obviously the Link team was well on their way to doing what they were doing. But I was just looking at a small picture at looking at regular expressions and some of the different query languages are difficult to write, and they're not very expressive. And so I was saying, why don't we, you know, have a better way of expressing this? And so I'm really happy that with Link we get kind of a common query language that you can use to query all different kinds of things, and you don't have to learn different query dialects all over the place.
Yeah, the one that really blew me away actually was with ADO.NET Data Services. You can set up a RESTful web service, that is a web service where you have resources at specific HTTP endpoints. So like if I wanted to expose all the employees and all the orders in my system, then I could tell someone, just go to http://machine name/employees, and you'll get back all the employees. And if you go to /employees/15, you'll get the employee with ID number 15. Well, the interesting thing they did with this, and Link plays two roles in here. Link plays a role on the server side, because what happens is ADO.NET Data Services will parse that URL, convert it into a link query that gets sent to, you know, whatever link provider is backing this up. So it'll pull employees from a database or pull it from in-memory objects or what have you. So Link's on the server side. But what I thought was really interesting was they exposed some metadata from these web services, which is not WSDL. It's not the typical SOAP-based web services at all. But the metadata that they expose, there's a tool, and I think it's called, I can't remember the tool that you can run against that metadata, but it's included. It'll be included in Service Pack 1 of Visual Studio 2008 that'll generate a client-side proxy for you. So just like with Asimex web services and WCF web services or anything that exposed WSDL, we had a tool in Visual Studio that we could point at the WSDL, it would generate a client-side proxy for us. Was essentially a class that you'd instantiate and invoke methods on it. Those methods would make a web service call. Well, with ADO.NET Data Services, what you get is a client-side data context class, which looks just like the data context class that's in Link to SQL, just like the data context class that's in the entity framework. So client-side, like in Silverlight or any C# program, you can instantiate one of these things and say, from E and employees where E.name equals Scott, select E, and get back a list of all the employees whose first name is Scott. What that data context does is transform your link query into essentially into a URL. Does it get to the server, pulls back some objects, instantiates them? It's really pretty amazing.
Right. So it's just doing that magic stuff behind the scenes to... You just specify what you want, and it's going to figure out how to
do it. You specify what you want. The C# compiler turns that into that abstract syntax tree, to that expression tree, and it's up to that class to parse that thing apart, turn it into an URL, and give you back some objects.
People are using Link to figure out different ways of doing things kind of at a higher level. Like I've seen both continuous link and parallel link. Continuous link gives you something sort of like an observable collection, where you do a link query and it's going to continually update your results. And then parallel link are those parallel FX, whatever, the extensions that will, you can use a link query and it'll automatically query against multiple, you know, it'll parallelize that out and run on multiple CPUs and potentially merging together different data sources and doing some really complex things behind the scenes. And all you have to do is write your link query using the parallel link extensions.
Yeah, I've played with that one a little bit. It's pretty interesting what they can do. Right. So in the example we've been using where you say from E and employees where E.name equals Scott, select E, if that's an in-memory collection, it might spin up four or five threads to go through that sequence of objects and find all the people named Scott. So obviously that's going to be a lot faster than trying to go through, with one thread, go through that collection of objects. Then something everyone should know about if they want to try Link at all is a tool called LinkPad, which was written by a fellow named Joseph Al-Bahari, who wrote the book C Sharp 3.0 in a Nutshell. So he produced this program called LinkPad, which is pretty darn amazing. Not only can you type in link expressions in there and execute them, and it'll show you the results, and in a sense, it's a lot like SQL Query Analyzer, almost, in that sense. You can just type in C-sharp statements into LinkPad and tell it to execute. So if there's any API that you want to play around with, if you want to play around with the file system APIs or Active Directory APIs or add a reference to some third-party assembly and just pull it in and instantiate classes and invoke methods on them, LinkPad will do that for you. It does it all interactively. It's a lot like that tool, I think it was called Snippet Compiler, where you could just execute arbitrary hunks of C-sharp code. It does that a lot. But the difference is with LinkPad, you can do things like make a connection to SQL Server, point it at a database, and it'll just dynamically create the classes that you would get like in Link to SQL. And so you can just say, okay, I want to play around with the Northwind database. So I'm going to say from P and products, where p.country equals USA, select P. It's pretty interesting.
I found that to be really helpful when I was trying to get the whole syntax down, because it is, you go into it thinking that it's SQL, and it's definitely not SQL, and or at least I did. And it was really helpful to just point it at a database and just kind of try stuff and look at the results on the fly and see what I was getting. I found especially the grouping syntax is tricky to figure out. I don't know if you have any tricks for that, but that was something where I kind of continually had to go back and look at sample queries to see how to do that.
Yeah, I don't have any tricks. I guess my only suggestion with the grouping is don't think of it like your typical SQL group, because you can actually get object hierarchies when you do grouping in with Link.
So, okay, Scott, one of the things that I hear from people is that it's not necessarily obvious how a Link query will get translated into SQL, and for example, specifically with Link to SQL. You know, you might end up with some really unexpected queries coming out of your code because of that. Have you found that to be true?
Yeah, there's definitely situations where you can get into trouble with Link if you're not watching what it's actually going to do with the database. And I guess to some extent that's true with any type of object relational mapping framework where the SQL is being dynamically generated. And you don't really know what's going to happen until you actually do some integration testing and some performance testing. And I won't say that Link to SQL or the Entity Framework either is perfect at generating SQL. Sometimes you look at what it generates and it's kind of catches you off guard at first. But yeah, it's just one of those situations where you almost just have to profile the application, do some integration tests, and then make sure you have indexes set up and things like that in SQL Server. And sometimes, honestly, both of these technologies are just in their first release, so they're not going to be able to do everything, and they're not going to be able to do everything really well. Sometimes you might have to fall back and go to ADO.NET instead, or some people still want to use stored procedures, I guess, too.
There's a few things you can use to see what's being generated. I know there's a, you can do datacontext.log, yeah. I believe, inside of... And so there you can view your generated SQL.
Yeah,
there.
There's easy ways to actually see what SQL it's going to do, but it's not something that you find out until the program's actually executing. Is the catch, you know?
Oh, right. The one other thing I was going to mention there was Scott Guthrie had a post titled "Link to SQL Debug Visualizer," and that's also handy if you're using Link to SQL, where you can. You can look at a query as it's running and see the exact SQL statement that's going to be executed.
So yeah, and in Visual Studio 2008, all you have to do is hover your mouse over a link query, and the query shows up. If it's a link to SQL, if it's working against link to SQL.
Time for the birdie call.
Oops. Yeah, my birds are in the house.
Hey, Scott, have you encountered any situations where you just couldn't make Link generate the sequel that you wanted? Like, it got confused, or it encountered a situation where it just didn't handle very effectively?
Well, I haven't hit the querying that hard. I spend a lot of time in the business intelligence space, and a lot of the data loads and things that we do are still written just in SQL. And we don't use any sort of object relational mapping for that kind of stuff. But from application code, the one place that still sort of concerns me are things like mass inserts and mass updates and bulk loads and things like that, where Link to SQL is just going to create too many round trips. And fortunately, there's a backdoor in all these technologies where you can walk up and, like with Link to SQL on the data context, there's an execute method where you can say, execute this arbitrary of SQL, and this is the type of object I expect to get back. So just take the result set that comes back from that and map the columns to public properties on this type. As far as I know, there's no link to MDX yet, which would be useful.
Dang!
That would be very useful.
I guess that's could be really hard to express all the multi-dimensional stuff in link syntax. I guess it's links up to it.
I don't know.
The small amount of MDX, I've done a lot less MDX than either of you guys have, but it really gave me a lot of appreciation for how complex it is.
You'd be surprised how little MDX I've actually done in 5 years of working with analysis services. I've tried to avoid it as much as possible. It's one of those topics that I look at and I think, if I learn this, I'll have to forget like five other things that I know. So
it's ridiculous.
I know how to build cubes. I know how to deploy cubes. But when it comes to querying cubes, I leave it all up to tools and controls and components.
I've been alpha testing some of Jeff Atwood's Stack Overflow site, and they're using Link to SQL. And they've got a cool thing down in the footer of the page where during debugging, they're writing out the actual executed SQL and the number of queries that are executing. And I mean, there's definitely some places where you'll do something that seems like it should be a simple query, and you've got like 600 queries running or something. Now, granted, it's still blazing fast, and they're running over pretty large data sets already that they've loaded. But I think that's pretty smart that they're viewing the actual SQL statistics while they're developing.
Yeah, that's a real good idea, and I think that's something that, again, it's not maybe specific to Link to SQL. I think that's something that kind of crops up with object relational mapping frameworks in general, in the sense that it's not always obvious when you're performing a query. Sometimes it is, but Link to SQL and things like Inhibernate both have the concept of lazy loading, where if I load in a customer class, it has an orders property, but that thing might not actually be the orders until I touch that property and try to iterate through it. And at that point, it's going to fire off another query. So I know like Allende has an HTTP module that he'll put, that he'll use during development to monitor the number of times Inhibernate's going to the database during a HTTP request. And, you know, if it's over like 2 or 3 or 4, whatever he configures it to, it raises some sort of alarm that says, oh, you might have a problem in this page. Scott K., any thoughts on that?
Understanding how memory management works and how all these data structures work is the difference between having a mechanic who just knows how to paint your car versus someone who knows how to fix your car.
So I'm curious, K. Scott, whether you have used something like Inhibernate, which is very popular in the alt circles, mm-hmm. And can, you know, do you, can you compare and contrast it to something like Link to SQL and in its effectiveness and its usability?
Well, to be honest, Link to SQL is a version 1 product, and it has certain limitations that were, let's just say, built into it. So whereas Inhibernate supports a wide variety of databases. Link to SQL also supports a wide variety of databases if you count just Microsoft SQL Server, the different versions, as a wide variety. So Link to SQL supports SQL 2000, SQL 2005, and I'm sure it'll support 2008 when it comes out. Whereas in Hibernate, you can use MySQL and DB2 and all these other ones. And then the other big thing that Hibernate does better is the flexibility in mapping. So in Link to SQL, if you have a SQL database with five tables in it, you're going to have five Link to SQL classes. You essentially get one class per table in your SQL database. Whereas in Hibernate, you have the ability to say things like, okay, I have a customer class, and inside of that class is another nested class. It's the address class that has three properties on it. And I want all that stuff mapped to a single table. With Link to SQL, unfortunately, that's just not possible. So it's still about 5 years ahead of these other technologies. Now, there's going to be a certain class of developers, though, that like Link to SQL better because you can do things like right-click on a project, say, add Link to SQL classes, and then just drag tables from Server Explorer, and poof, everything's sort of generated for you. Where in Hibernate, there's some different tools and some different Visual Studio plugins that can generate the Hibernate mappings for you, but it's typically considered a little more complex.
When I first started looking at Link to SQL, I was reflecting around in the source code, and it looks like it was originally built to support multiple database providers. I mean, it has a sort of internal provider model that I've heard was sort of hidden away more for political reasons than for technical reasons. So that's definitely one disappointing thing, especially as, you know, I work for an ISV where we have to support multiple database platforms, and that sort of takes Link to SQL out of the picture.
Yeah.
So that's definitely a disappointment for me.
Definitely. If you have to support multiple databases, and then if you have a legacy database, so if you have a database that already exists and you're looking at using an object relational mapping tool against that database, chances are you'll have a much better chance at getting something workable out of in Hibernate, again, because of the flexible mappings, than you would Link to SQL. Because with Link, you're going to get whatever's in the schema. Within a Hibernate, you can massage things a little bit. It's still, legacy databases can still be a uphill climb, though, with an ORM.
There are some loopholes in Link to SQL. Out of the box, it's going to give you active record style, so it's table to class mm-hmm. mapping. But you can use views or stored procedures and then remove classes. So you can say, if I've got three or four tables that map to one class, I can create a view and then remove those original tables, and I've got my... But really, you're kind of fighting the system at that point. I mean, it works, but it's clearly more designed for the more active record style.
That's true. And for some people, it's just not acceptable to have the schema bleed into the business layer, the domain layer, that much. And there's some things that you just won't be able to abstract away with Link to SQL.
The one project we used it for was called video.show, and it was a Silverlight 1.0 YouTube knockoff, sort of. Now, it was a lot smaller scale and all that, but the idea was to a community video sharing site. And with that, we were able to define, it was a new project, we were able to define our database, and we were able to say, okay, like, number one, it was a simple database. I mean, you've got videos and users and, you know, not a lot more. We did have the ASP.NET membership tables, mm-hmm. and those were the more complex ones. But really, it was a simple database schema, and we had control over it. And in that case, it really did work pretty well. As soon as we defined our database, day one, we're able to write queries and start going with it. So that's
a perfect scenario for Link to SQL. The other Linkish thing that I've really dug lately is Link to XML and the new XML API. So it's been a real joy working with XML again and not having to use system.xml.xml document and write all sorts of helper methods.
I've been playing a little bit more lately with HTML. Just a few things I'm working on are requiring me to clean up and parse poorly formatted HTML documents. And I've been looking at HTML Agility Pack, which came out like 2003 or something, right? And it's a handy way to get XML, like, you can treat poorly formatted HTML as if it was well formatted XML. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a few people have been using link to XML over HTML Agility Pack, which is kind of interesting. I haven't tried it yet, but it definitely looks like an interesting way you could just directly write a link query over HTML and say from whatever elements where type equals A, you know, node name equals A and href is not null, you know, give me whatever. So kind of neat.
That'd be interesting. That has that software been updated?
It actually has. Yeah, they pushed it out to CodePlex.
Oh, okay.
The last update that I saw was, I think, late 2007.
Okay.
But it does, I mean, there's continual activity on the forums, and there's, it looks like it's, I mean, it definitely hasn't just faded away. There's still continual work on it. And there's more than one person that's doing check-ins, which is good to see.
Oh, that's good. Because the last time I went looking for it, it was a couple of years ago, but I remember it seemed to be hard to find, and like a couple links were broken, and then the download was like 2 years old. So I was wondering if it was if it was going to make it or not.
No, yeah, it's working for me, and I'm using it in a project now, and it's out on CodePlex, and there's decent support on the forums and stuff. So it's nice to see it continue.
So what do you think, Scott K?
You know, I certainly couldn't repair my TV set if it went down.
You mentioned sort of domain mapping earlier and how some people don't like to have their persistent stuff bleed over into their domains. And I know that Linked to SQL supports some level of, you know, POCO-style, you know, programming models where you can define your mappings separate from the domain and not generate a domain from the database, but start with your objects first. But I haven't heard a lot of reports about whether that's just limiting, whether ultimately you run out of steam with Link, you know, going down that road, or whether it's really flexible enough to handle that.
Well, you definitely have to be aware of the limitations. For like the nested types limitation is one I mentioned earlier, and that can really hurt you in a rich domain model. But you can definitely start POCO, so you can definitely write just plain old CLR objects, and a later time just define some XML mapping files, feed that to a Link to SQL data context, and say, here's the mapping file. So these are the objects I want. Now you could get them out of the table, and that works. But it's something you have to be aware of the limitations when you do that. It's not completely rich, and it's nowhere near where Hibernate is in that space at this point.
Just to interject here, that's at K. Scott's post called "Two Link to SQL Myths."
Right, and the entity framework at this point doesn't do POCO at all. So supposedly that's coming in the next version.
That's kind of funny. Like I've heard more love for Link to SQL than the entity framework from the kind of alt.NET crowd, because there is a Link to SQL is a lot more kind of lightweight and in some ways more malleable than entity framework, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's true. If anyone wants to look at this closely, I'd recommend, first of all, there's Ian Cooper's blog posts. He's a blogger on codebetter.com. So he wrote a whole series of blog posts about architecting a Link to SQL application. And I think there were like 9 posts in total. That's very, very good. Another place to look is a project on CodePlex called Background Motion, which uses Link to SQL and a repository pattern and to build an application that I think it was like the code for a website that would catalog Vista screensavers or something like that. I don't remember exactly, but the code's very interesting in the sense that it uses some of the DDD, domain-driven design concepts, and it uses test-driven development and doesn't have your typical drag-and-drop stuff. But the whole reason I think that works with Link to SQL and not the entity framework is that the entity framework has some complexities to it, and they have this concept of creating this rich conceptual model out of a database schema where you have to go through sort of 3 layers of mappings, and it's you can't just write your objects first and then later map them. Well, I guess you could, but the tools just don't work that way, and it's a whole lot of XML for the entity framework mapping, just a huge amount of XML, Whereas Link to SQL is pretty straightforward. You say things like, I have a table named employees. I have a CLR type called odecode.employees. And so there's a property on there called first name. I want it to go to this column. And a property called last name. I want it to go to this column. And there's a ID property. It's going to be a, that's the primary key. It's going to be something that's generated in the database. And the XML is actually pretty readable. And I know, like, Ian Cooper had this great series of blog posts. And towards the end, he had a post also that said, I really hope that Microsoft keeps nurturing Link to SQL. You know, if we could just get a few more features in there, it would be great. Some additional mappings and so forth. And it's just conceptually simpler than the entity framework.
There was one other thing that you'd written about recently that I thought was interesting. Rob Connery's doing that MVC storefront, mm-hmm. and you wrote about the lazy loading there.
That was a weird thing in Link to SQL, where Rob's architecture for his MVC storefront was that he didn't want to use any of the Link to SQL generated classes in his business logic. So he was essentially using Link to SQL as just sort of a data transfer layer to pull stuff out of the database, and from there he was going to put it into his business objects. But he still wanted some features like lazy loading. So a lot of people think that in order to do lazy loading and Link to SQL, you have to use this special type. There's two special types, entity set, which represents a collection, and entity ref, which represents a reference to a parent object that has a foreign key relationship. And those sorts of situations get lazy loaded. And a lot of people think, oh, you need the entity stuff to be lazy loaded, but it turns out you don't. But anyway, in Rob's code, he was trying to pull this off without using lazy loading. He created his own lazy list class, and it wasn't working for him. And I can't remember exactly how Rob explained it, but for him, it was fundamentally broken. And I just wanted to dig into it a little bit. And the details are a little fuzzy to me now, but from what I remember is there's some code inside of Link to SQL that says, okay, you have an object that has a property of type iList, and you want to assign the results of some database query to that. So the left-hand side is iList, and then it does some type checking. If the right-hand side is also returning something that implements iList, it'll just hand that reference over. Which means in Link to SQL has the concept of deferred execution. So I can define a query and get back an actual iQueryable interface and not actually execute a SQL statement at that point until I actually walk up to that interface and try to go through the results. Well, Rob was doing that, but what Link to SQL was doing was seeing that his lazy list class that he built, for whatever reason, it decided that it had to actually execute the query right then and there because he was trying to assign a lazy list to something of type iList. And it turns out all he had to do, instead of assigning that lazy list, if he just treated his lazy list as an iList, that interface just showed that to Link to SQL, then the deferred execution worked just fine. Might not be the easiest thing to explain in a podcast, but if you look at the post, you can kind of get the idea of just, instead of saying new lazy list and having Link to SQL see a lazy list reference, just say lazylist.create and return an iList reference, and Link to SQL is perfectly happy with just copying that reference and not executing queries. That make any sense?
I understand how to look at what SQL statements are being executed, mm-hmm. and go, this is good or this is bad. But understanding exactly, like troubleshooting those sort of things, the expression trees and how they're generated and when they're evaluated, how do you do that?
Well,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, some of that actually was just done with Reflector. So I was able to find the exact bit of code inside of Link to SQL that was taking something on the right-hand side and assigning it to something on the left-hand side during your select operation. And I saw it do type checking to see, okay, is this an iList and is that an iList? And if they're both not an iList, then we need to actually enumerate the whole collection and create a new list of T for whatever reason. So that was Reflector.
Wow.
And then it was just one of those situations where that code was down so far, I wasn't quite sure if I was understanding it. And so then it was just a case of writing some, I just wrote some unit tests to did some asserts and figured out, oh, yep, that's exactly what it's doing. It's that link to SQL mapping code that's actually making his lazy list fail. It's kind of weird. I'm not sure why they did it that way.
You know what I'm going to have to do during this? We didn't actually say that Scott Kuhn was out this week, just going to have to grab some audio. No, that's fine. I think I should grab some audio from previous weeks and just have him ask like ridiculous questions that don't really make sense here, and then we'll just ignore him.
So what do you think, Scott K?
So I think the real question is, Oslo, is it crap or not?
Oh, I have one more thing. Can I interject one more thing here?
I was going to say, the show needs more Kevin.
Need more Kevin Bell. I just wanted to mention that I don't remember which one it was, but one of our very early podcasts, I complained about how in Link to SQL they didn't handle database changes very well, especially as far as the designer works. So you make changes to your table structure, and there's no way to simply say, okay, go refresh the designer now and figure out the differences. And I was very frustrated in that. But I did recently run across a project that somebody put together, and I'll have to find the link, where they were, it's basically an extension for Visual Studio to resync the designer and the database.
Hmm.
I'm pretty excited about that. I think that'll be a very useful tool to have in the arsenal. And then, of course, eventually, hopefully Microsoft will fix this in the next version of Link, but I thought that was a pretty unfortunate limitation, so I'm happy that we have a way to address it.
I was really happy that you pointed that out to me right when I think I mentioned on Twitter that I was using Link to SQL, and you cautioned me about that. So we changed our database as rarely as possible. And then once we did, it was a pain, though. You just have to, you change the database, you have to remove all the tables from the diagram, add them back in, recompile, make sure nothing broke. And I've been, like I said, I was talking to Jeff Atwood about this recently, and they've customized some of their generated names after it's, you know, after it's generated. And so if they change their database, they have to go in and redo those customizations, which is kind of a pain.
It's unfortunate. I don't know why Microsoft does that, but I'll tell you one approach I've used, which is I'll use the designer maybe one time if I already have a database to generate a DBML file, and then make changes in the designer if I want to rename things, because it'll pick up all the relationships and so forth. And then moving forward, if you make database changes, just modify the DBML by hand. And you can generate your mapping file from the DBML file using SQL Metal, which is a command line tool. And this is not a perfect workflow, obviously. It would be nice to have it automated, but Visual Studio is not going to help you do it. So
the one thing that I would do if I was going to make any customizations or changes, I would always just generate directly off of what you get when you drag and drop stuff in. And then it generates partial classes. So if you're going to make any changes, I would inherit, or I would add properties and hide things, do whatever, but do that in the partial class. Then when you regenerate, your partial classes aren't affected.
That's true, yeah.
That's something I've used going back to, I used to build collections off of Codesmith, and that was definitely helpful there. It was just use partial classes, and then regenerate all you want, and you're not going to affect your overrides.
So I think that wraps up this episode of Herding Code. Hopefully we'll revisit Link again in the future, and we look forward to Scott Kuhn rejoining us also. So thanks for listening.